Frankly, I don't know much about it, about Deutscher and the role he played. There was opposition to the formation, but Deutscher played no role, so far as I can remember, in those groups and individuals who were involved in the discussion around the formation of the Fourth International. Played no role whatsoever. I can't even remember his name from that period. There was Spock, you know, Henry Spock now, who's the premier of, he was the head of a workers' tendency in, and yes, don't forget what this period was. This was 1933, when Hitler had come to power. Yeah, there was, and the Spanish Civil War, there was a revolutionary upsurge throughout Europe. The Popular Front in 1935 headed off a revolutionary development in France. The working class was on a move everywhere. They were either defeated or derailed by the policy of the social democracy and the Communist Party. So you don't laugh about Spock. There are other people who are even to the right of him today who considered themselves revolutionists in those days. They didn't come in. There was a centrist grouping around the Independent Labour Party in Great Britain that established an international center. And most of these people gravitated to that center. They had a centrist grouping in Germany, the Lovestone grouping in the United States, and a number of similar groupings throughout the world. Further questions? Yeah, I know. I see, though. I want to try and spread the questions around, if you don't mind. All right. Yeah. Yeah, you're all right. These other cameras have had three or four questions.
No.
No.
Yes,
I know. The Stalinist group. Oh, don't laugh at it. The Stalinists that characterize it as Trotsky's group. No. If you read Trotsky's books on Spain, we broke with the PUM because they went along with this People's Front. They entered the government in Catalonia.
They also crushed the workers'
rising in Barcelona. Yeah. No, we broke with the PUM. There was Andres Nin. One of the leaders of the PUM, who was one of those involved in the negotiations on the organization of the international, but they never came in. Like some kind of a fascist, so you never can tell what to happen.
On the point on Deutscher, just a couple of days ago I was reading a review by Deutscher in the now defunct American Socialist magazine on Trotsky's diary.
What magazine?
The American Socialist magazine, which...
Yeah, but you were reading it when? A few weeks ago?
I have old copies.
Huh?
I have old copies.
Oh, you're... I see. I thought maybe we had
enough. I was thinking about my
life.
And so in his review of Deutscher, he says that Trotsky's Diary in Exile, he points out that, after alluding to all the merits of the diary and so forth, that with regard to Trotsky's founding the Fourth International, the work that was going on at the time, the concern that Trotsky showed with the building of it, of this international, he points out that some of us felt that Trotsky that he overestimated his capacity to build a new international. Well, that I think he means not only Trotsky's personal capacity, but the capacity of the cadres that were left, and underestimated the forces for reform existing within the Soviet Union. That's how he summed up the disagreements existing at that time. I suspect that the overwhelming feeling at that time, in the early 30s, was on the insufficiency of the cadre and the idea of a capacity for self-reform in the Soviet Union as only latter-day thought approached. I wanted to ask, though, with regard to the Stalin-Hitler Pact.
Well, let me get to this point. Let's finish this point before you go on. Yeah, well, okay. I want to contrast, if you permit me. I want to contrast the a revolutionary man of action, which Trotsky was, with a commentator like Deutscher. Trotsky was serious. He was a serious revolutionary fighter. And his words were followed by deeds. When he announced that the Third International was dead, was no longer a viable instrumentality that could function in the interest of all working class, immediately says we need a new international. He proceeded from the struggle of his whole lifetime. That is the fight for the world socialist revolution and the necessity of a world organization of the working class. So he says, Third International is dead, we've got to build a Fourth International. Now remember, 5 years elapsed between the proclamation and the actual organization. 5 years in which there was a tremendous discussion on an international scale. Maybe some of your scholars here would be interested. I have the old bulletins. I'd gladly send them to you and you can look them over. It was a tremendous discussion. It went over, a period of 5 years until finally there were sifted out the centrists, the waivers, the Deutschers, and others like him, and those who were prepared to go along to establish the organization met and adopted the program and established the organization. Actually, it was the American Party who sponsored the transition program to the founding conference of the Fourth International in 1938. We adopted the transition program at the founding convention of the SWP. The Labor Party slogan was not part of the transition program. It was a separate discussion, although it's a slogan of a transitional character. And so it doesn't appear in the transitional program, which is a world program. You can't advocate a Labor Party, say, for France, where the mass parties are either in the Communist Party or Social Democracy, or in Italy, where the workers are in the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. Now, what was your second question? I just wanted to point out to you what I consider the essential difference between... See, Deutscher, I know, has all kinds of explanations of why it wasn't feasible, it wasn't practical, and so forth and so on. He's not the type who feels responsibility for what he says. He's a commentator. He's not a revolutionary man of action. Although I have great respect for his scholarly contribution.
I was just going to say, that's the role he seemed to be playing in this review of his diary. On the question I have on these polyvalent attack and the effects, well, no, not that much, and the turn after that you describe where the Communist Party, for in the interest of real or supposed interest of the Soviet Union, kind of fell off from any support of civil rights or working class gains in this country, signing those strike pledges and so forth, opposing March in Washington. Did they gain anything immediately out of that?
Out of the what?
Out of these actions. What were they? No, they were obviously trying by these means to prove their loyalty to the American government and the capitalist system, and thereby move the authorities here that much quicker. Is there any evidence that the American government entered the war on the side of against the fascists, Hitler, any earlier than they would have anyway by these self-effacing actions on their part?
No, I don't think so. You see, what the comrade there said before, there's a great deal of validity to what he said. I don't know his, the comrade's name. Is that they had been led into a trap, really. That is, while the policy of a British and French imperialism was to try and direct Hitler's attention to the east, to Russia, you see, as against an armed attack on the west. There was this maneuvering going on. Yes, they had been making consistent concessions to Hitler, and undoubtedly in Moscow they were very well aware of these devious schemes that they were concocting behind their back. But it was reliance upon this diplomatic maneuvering that had led them into this trap, you see. It led them into the trap where it was a question of who is going to betray whom. See, they yelled betrayal the moment they signed the Hitler-Stalin Pact, because at the very time that they signed the pact, the commissions were in Moscow discussing with the Soviet Union measures based upon the concept of collective security to take against Hitler. That is, a military alliance. It was while the commission the French and British Commission were in Moscow that they announced the British, the Stalin Hitler pact. And then they sent them off packing home. See. And then they yelled betrayal. No, it wasn't betrayal. Not if you judge it upon that level, you see, and the level of diplomatic maneuvering between in a power struggle, you see. It was reducing the whole concept of the class struggle to a power struggle confined to the diplomatic maneuvering level, which is consists of the real essence of the betrayal. Well, at that time, you see, in beginning about 1939, 1940, with the outbreak of war in Europe, there was the beginning of an armaments program in this country, which revived the economy and opened up for factories, industry, for the employment of millions of workers, which reached after 1941, after our entry, of course, there was full employment. But the Negroes were more or less excluded, you see. They were, again, the last to be hired, you see. There was discrimination in the armed forces, there was discrimination in industry, discrimination in employment. And so there developed a movement under the leadership of A. Philip Randolph. Well, the march called then the March on Washington movement, a different movement than what you have now. Then it was an organization which was set up branches in the various cities throughout the country, like the Negro American Labor Council does now. It was not looked upon like a one-shot proposition, but as the beginning of a big campaign to break down the barriers which had been erected, the Jim Crow barriers, which have been left intact by the administration. Now, the very threat, see, the march never materialized. The very threat of the march induced Roosevelt to issue his decree, his Fair Employment Practices Decree, see, in which opened up the employment in industry for the Negroes, and the march was called off. But it was a militant movement. They were prepared to take direct action to break down these barriers. I think Randolph, again, compromised on this. Yeah. That he really didn't get, he didn't really succeed in breaking down the Jim Crow barriers. He just opened up a little chink. That is, it was a concession, a token concession, because there was a great shortage of labor in the country after they began war production, and there was no problem about putting people to work.
In the early years of 1930, the Trotskyist movement really involved in what you call a propaganda period. And in 1933, 1934, they had an agitational period. They characterized
Well, I tried to indicate how we functioned when we were considered ourselves a faction of the Communist Party. When we decided to abandon that policy, the turn to mass work meant that the members of the party would enter the mass organizations of the working class, the unions and other organizations, and begin to function as independent representatives of a political party.
What was the Trotskyists during the propaganda period?
We would support the Communist Party then. That's when we were a faction of the unions. That is, we didn't go with them into the revolutionary trade unions, but in the unions where they still remain, or wherever we may have happened to be, we supported generally the Communist Party. We supported the Communist Party factions in the various organizations and institutions in which we were active. Now, about the propaganda, see, essentially, the SWP is a propaganda group today. We're not a mass party. You see, I don't know what distinction you make between propaganda and agitation. We always carry on propaganda, agitation, and action. See, we make these various distinctions. Sometimes you can carry on propaganda, agitation, or action around a single slogan. For example, the Labor Party slogan for a Labor Party. At this time, it would be what we call a propaganda slogan, because there's no real movement in the working class or a Labor Party. If there was, say, a manifestation of a tendency in the working class to break from the Democratic Party and move towards the Labor Party, the slogan would become one of agitation. We would then say, instead of coming out generally and say we favor the idea of a Labor Party, we'd say build a Labor Party now. That's the difference between a slogan of propaganda, a slogan of agitation. Then, if the movement was a little further advanced, we have people in mass organizations, we would come in with resolutions calling upon the union or a mass organization to establish a Labor Party unit. You see, in a city, in a hamlet, in a town, or in a community. So one slogan at different times can be used in different ways. Now, the characteristic of the group as a whole is determined by its link with the masses. And so long as we have not achieved yet a link between the vanguard and the mass, you function more or less as a propaganda group. But a propaganda group with an important distinction. A propaganda group that acts like a party, that aspires to be a party. You see, but doesn't consider itself as a substitute for the mass organizations of the workers. You're going to run into this time and again. I heard some of the young comrades talking about the problem as it arises in the civil rights struggle. You can't, for example, you can't substitute the YSA for the action organizations that are leading these actions. That's not the function of the YSA. It'd be impossible for them to carry that out. You're too few in number. You're not, you don't have the right color, most of you. You're not, the Negroes are not going to accept any white leadership, not today, you see. So that your essential task is to participate in this movement, support it to the extent of your capability, but to invest it with political consciousness. You see, that's your essential task, to make socialists out of these militants now who are engaging in these actions. Because without socialists, you're not going to build a socialist movement. You're not going to build a movement that is capable of transforming society and solving the problem, both of discrimination and of exploitation of workers on the job. The two are related. So, when you say propaganda group, we have this dispute, if you remember, with the Cochrane Act. They said that we're nothing but a propaganda group, that therefore we have to give up pretending or even acting like we were a party. We said, no, we're a propaganda group, but we've got to continue to act like a party because we aspire to be a party. They say, quit running an election campaign. Quit trying to lead actions of any kind. All you've got to do is publish a little magazine or maybe a little newspaper, hold a few educational classes and a few forums. That's all. That's the limit to which a propaganda group would go. We say, no, that consists of a formula for liquidating the group, for going out of business, and that's it. Proved it. They went off to experiment with this concept. They were in business for, what, a year or a year and a half, 2 years. They published a magazine, an attractive magazine, didn't have much to say. But it was a very nice format, had good pictures in it, and occasional article that was worthwhile reading. And they continued that for about 2 years, and then they gave up the ghost. They quit because they weren't serious. Now, we're a propaganda group that aspires to be a party, and so we've got to act like a party. So we run candidates and election campaigns. And we have all the other activities. We participate in the actions of the working class in any section of the community in which we there is an identity, even making a half a step forward. Very good.
I saw the last issue of it. Again, I would have been pleased to come out. And I read their editorial comment on why they were going out of business. And summed up, it said essentially, because nobody wants to buy our ideas, we're not going to bother putting them out anymore. And they went and said, well, we've tried for these years to put out this magazine, but we haven't been able to support ourselves financially. And we're getting tired of going to the red and going broke ourselves putting it out. And therefore, this proves that there really isn't any place for such a magazine on the American scene because we aren't willing, we don't have a big enough mass base to support it. And therefore, since it's not, they said, we don't want such a thing as a house organ. This is what they refer to the militant as. They say, well, this is just a single point of view, you know. A lot of people don't support it, and therefore we can't quit publishing.
Yeah. Well, they took revenge on the working class, but I don't think the workers, to my knowledge, haven't done any excessive mourning for their passing. I would say that the slogan is an agitational slogan because there is a definite movement. There are manifestations in various parts of the country of formations of Negroes who are breaking with the concept of supporting the Democratic or Republican Party. Some of them who have announced their own candidacies or supportive candidacies against the Republican and Democratic Party. You see, others who have taken up the idea, people like Conrad Lynn, like Bill Worthy, Clegg in Detroit and others who have reached the conclusion that we cannot conduct any effective struggle for freedom so long as we remain tied to the Democratic and Republican Party, and who are advocating the formation of a Freedom Now Party. Now, how much success they'll have, we don't know. That is dependent upon the mood of the mass. But I would say that if the labor movement was in this stage, then our Labor Party slogan would be of an agitational character. So the Freedom Now Party, in our opinion, is the slogan is that of an agitation slogan, and can rapidly become a slogan of action. That is, I mean, on a national scale, it is already a slogan of action in some localities. And it would become that, for example, if you can get a militant Negro candidate here to run against for mayor. I think it would be a very good development.
Yeah. On this question of the Deutscher and Cochran and the American Socialists and all that, on sale is this copy International Socialist Review. Quarter or so, which has an article titled Case History of an Experiment, which is the story of the history of the attempt to substitute the American Socialists as a propaganda thing for the SWP, how they tried to do it, what happened, why they failed, by Murray Wise, which I found very interesting to listen to. So I recommend that. It's all about that, and the implications of what about Deutscher and the whole substitution of commentary for politics. The question I want to ask is, it's been 25 years since the transitional program was adopted. Do you feel that in essence it still remains the cornerstone document of the Fourth Amendment?
I would say so. It's a basic program. It would require, see, the transition program doesn't contain all the answers for all time. I would say that it requires, it would require amendation, amplification, depending upon the development of the struggle in various parts of the world. But basically, the demands, the character of the program itself as a program transition between the immediate demand and the ultimate demand struggle for socialism is essentially valid. For example, you can't, it's the same thing we were just discussing. There are many, many slogans in the transition program that you could not use now. It wouldn't be realistic, even in a propaganda sense. And you can't say then that it's applicable, all slogans are applicable under all conditions. For example, the slogan that would be most applicable today out of the transition program would be the sliding scale of hours, or the sliding scale of wages and hours. That is, you're confronted with a situation of mounting unemployment, a trend which is going to be accelerated, not be eliminated, and of continuing inflation. So it would be applicable. That's an applicable. That's a slogan around which the struggle against inflation and unemployment can successfully be waged. Another slogan, for example, the slogan of the militarization section. This would not be applicable, in my opinion, at this present stage of the development, where it was previously, 1940, for example. So there again, some of the slogans become applicable in the sense of propaganda, agitation, or action slogan, depending upon the development of the struggle itself. Now, I don't need a brick house to fall on me, Jack. I know that you asked me to call attention to the comrades of the Labor Party slogan. So I got to give my sales pitch now. This pamphlet, we discussed yesterday how at one time we opposed the Labor Party slogan, and at a later time we adopted it. We adopted it in 1938. We were opposed to it when we were in the SP. Well, I note that the first article by Trotsky, this is by Trotsky, on the question of the Labor Party, was written in 1932, in which he then expresses the reasons why at that time we were opposed to the Labor Party slogan. And then later, in later discussions with him, when the he tells why it was necessary to make a change. And so if you haven't read this, it's a very useful and informative series on the development of the Labor Party. Any other piece of literature you want to?
Everything you mentioned tonight is on sale.
Good. How much longer are we going to go?
Another couple questions.
Okay.
Could you go on a little bit into how this concept of a transitional program is
of this
in the 20s or the early 30s?
Well, actually, in my opinion, that's the unique contribution of Trotsky to the theory and practice of Marxism, the concept of the transition program. It was used by the Bolsheviks, actually used, but never formulated as succinctly. And actually, Trotsky drew upon his experience in the struggle of the 1905 and 1917 in Russia, which established the first workers' state. And the concept was there previously had been no connection between the so-called immediate demands, which were advocated by the social democracy, and the ultimate demand of socialism. That the two were separate, you see. And so the immediate demands, that is, the demands for reforms, became the real program of the socialist democracy, and the struggle for socialism became sort of a Sunday school exercise, or they used to hold picnics, a lot of picnics in the early Socialist Party. On state occasions, the leaders of the party would come out for socialism. They had nothing at all to do with their activity in the mass movement. There, everything was based upon the immediate demands, the reforms, demands in the unions, demands in the by the parliamentary socialists. The idea of the transition program, the transition demands, is to provide a bridge between the objective necessity of the working class to find solution for some of its historical problems, and the lack of consciousness, to bridge this lack of consciousness in action, which will lead the workers then from the struggle around which an immediate demand, or what seems to be an immediate demand, into the struggle for socialism. Such a demand as the sliding scale of wages and hours. Most of these demands actually are incapable of being realized under capitalism. You couldn't possibly realize the demand of the sliding scale of wages and hours under capitalism, because that's the mode that would prevail under socialism. It means that as productivity increases, hours of work are reduced. And as either the cost of living increases, wages are increased. Impossible of achieving, as you can see, under capitalism. It doesn't mean the 30-hour. 30-hour week is just a popularization of the slogan for the sliding scale of wages and hours, sliding scale of hours, the 30 for 40. But that doesn't, the 30 doesn't answer a problem. You get a 30-hour week with the development of automation and mechanization, that's not going to solve the problem of unemployment, you see. So you'd have to go to the 20-hour week, or the 15-hour week, or the 10-hour, whatever it is. That's the concept of the sliding scale of wages and hours. Under socialism, that's what will prevail, you see. As productivity increases, hours of work will be reduced. As if the cost of living rises, wages will increase proportionately. But we see, we say to the worker, we say, all right, we say that it cannot be achieved, but you're convinced that it can. Let's join and struggle for this demand. Let's join and struggle now for 30 for 40. If that doesn't answer the problem of unemployment, let's join and struggle for 25-hour a week. You get the idea of it provides for answering the gap between the consciousness of the workers and the necessity of the working class to solve this problem of unemployment. If they don't, you're going to have what they have in Germany. You're going to have fascism or war. I mean, the problem will be solved, will be resolved on the bones and blood and frames of the workers. By the capitalists will resolve the problem, but in their own way. And the workers will pay. That means not only workers, but students and the people generally will pay. That's the difference between the transition demand and an immediate demand. An immediate demand, say, for higher pay or for pensions or for social security.
Given that example of the candidate of the SLP in the New York elections, and every time they'd ask him, well, what should we do about unemployment? He said, why, on page 90 of Frederick Bagel, we need the dictatorship of the proletariat. And they say, well, what should we do about the traffic problem in New York? He'd say, on page 90 of Frederick Bagel, what we need is the dictatorship of the proletariat. He had no transition slogan, no bridge in between.
Well, because they're against reforms, you see. They're for the revolution, period. And if you're for reforms, then you're a reformist, and if you're a reformist, you're a betrayer, you're a labor skate, and who wants to be a labor skate? Yeah, very simple. You know, the early socialist movement took the same attitude towards the Negro struggle. That is, they say the Negro struggle, there's no separate struggle, there's no separate problem, will be resolved within the framework of the struggle for socialism. Therefore, there's no special Negro problem, you see. They didn't recognize the special character of the oppression and exploitation of the Jim Crow system. I don't think they do today, not the Socialist Party. So it's the same concept. There was no concept of any transitional. All right, one more question, and then we adjourn to, you can all have a piece of my birthday cake.
Well, I didn't ask you a question.
Oh, you want to take the floor? Okay.
No, I'm asking a question.
Okay.
Thank
you. All right.
You mentioned that you thought the military policy was not exactly applicable today, and since this is a subject which is of academic interest to YSA circles, I wonder if you might expand.
I didn't say it wasn't applicable. I say it.
A different form.
No, it would not be. It would not be correct to advance it as a propaganda slogan at this time. No, it may be applicable next year. I don't know. A year after.
Specifically, with regard to this military thing, the SPU convention, in our document, we advanced the slogan,
SPU too.
It was freedom in the armed forces. I don't know exactly how it's formulated, but it was democracy within the armed forces. And it struck me as kind of a funny slogan, and I wasn't sure it was because I was any
Well, we're for democracy in the armed forces. We're for the right of the ranks to elect their officers instead of having appointed. As I say, I don't say, see how, whether it would be the kind of a slogan calculated to set the SPU aflame. I doubt it. You see, your slogans have got to be, they've got to be tailored to fit some need and a level of consciousness of the people that you're dealing with. Now, if it's way in advance of their consciousness, it has no real applicability. They think that you're way off in Wonderland somewhere. So it's got to have some applicability, some reasonability. You can't play with slogans, you know. Slogans that are useful and adaptable and realistic at one time are not at another time. Okay.
Any other questions? Well, before you go.
Well, tomorrow, I would say that tomorrow we're meeting again. Tomorrow we'll take up the development of on the labor movement from the post-war period to date.
There's someone out of my one of my name, George.
Well, I was going to ask if there's